When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, welcome back to another episode of This Week in History with me, Dan the Viking. Third week in a row now, I haven't had to do anything. And to be fair, I haven't done anything for months. But we have come to the end at the moment of Dad's podcasts. He's done quite a few, and this one has been there for months now, hasn't it? It's been one that's been... He's had this done for a long time. The problem with Dad is he did this one. I don't know anything about it. And then he kept coming out with these better ones. Or more, not necessarily better, but more well-known podcasts. Like the Donner Party and the Statue of Liberty. What else do we do? Waterloo. Do you know what I mean? Things like that where they're a little bit more well-known. So this one has just been sitting there, and currently this is the last one he's got left. Now, I'll be honest with you guys, I have seen a list of about another 30 that he's looking at doing, but at the moment this is the last one that is fully finished and ready to go. So we have, I would say, it's a bit of a strange podcast considering what it is, and the story behind it. I know very little about this because, like I say, it's one Dad explained to me, and that is probably all I know. You know, when you sort of say, well, what about this? And then it was...
Yeah, I'll give you the story, and then, yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, yeah, that sounds quite interesting. And then it's like, do you want to do this one, or do you want to do the Battle of Waterloo? And I thought, nah, the Battle of Waterloo's got to go. And then it's been, so it's been a bit like that. And, this one, what are we talking about?
We're talking about a shipwreck.
Another one. You're good at these.
I'm good at the maritime ones. Yeah, I do quite a few of them. It is one of my interests. So,
but we're an island.
We are,
and it's
we did have the best navy in the world
for a long time.
For a long, long time. Yeah,
about 500 years.
But guess what? This isn't about anything British.
No, no, it's not.
It's not the British one. Yeah, so I kind of like that one. So. I said we've done quite a few sea-related podcasts, and unfortunately, most of these have involved a ship sinking.
Yeah.
Or something sinking.
Yeah.
This one is no different.
No.
Okay. Everybody has heard of the Titanic.
So, yes.
So the 1912 transatlantic liner which sunk after hitting an iceberg in the freezing waters of the North Atlantic.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was a good podcast, by the way, if you want to go back and
it was actually to that. I enjoyed doing that. It was one of my first ones.
Yes, it was brilliant. It was quite an early episode actually, but it is worth a reel back if you want to.
I mean, there was substantial loss of life in the Titanic, over 1,700 people.
Yes.
But it's nowhere near the worst. And this podcast is about just that.
The worst.
The worst. The biggest loss of life in a single incident on the sea.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't mean to trivialise those 1,700, but on this podcast, we are talking about a ship with the loss of life that is believed to exceed 9,900.
Wow.
And 1,200 survivors.
It's a very full ship.
It's a very full ship.
I mean, you think, like, the Titanic at 1,700 died. How many were actually on the liner?
2,228.
Yeah. So not many actually survived that. But
700 and...
But you're talking about a ship that's got five times the amount of people on it.
Yeah.
So was it bigger?
Not necessarily.
No. I say I didn't think it was.
Yeah.
Not much.
So this is the story of the worst single shipwreck in terms of loss of life in the whole of known history.
Yeah.
So, do you want me to tell you about it?
Yes, of course.
Okay. The year was 1945.
Mm-hmm.
The place was the Baltic Sea.
Is this before or after the end of the Second World War?
It's before the end of the Second World War.
Right, okay.
The place, like I said, the Baltic Sea. Now, mm-hmm. that is a very, very cold ocean. The ship was the Wilhelm Gustloff.
Yeah.
All right. The Wilhelm Gustloff went down while carrying over 10,000 civilian refugees escaping from a war zone. At the time of her demise, she was sailing in one of the coldest oceans on Earth. It's the Baltic Sea.
Yeah, that's why the word Baltic is cold.
Yeah. Given that more people died on this ship than any other in history, it surprises me, to be honest, how so few people actually know anything about it. But by the end of this story, you will know why so few people know about it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a bit of a twist.
There is. So what kind of ship was the Wilhelm Gustloff? Believe it or not, it was a civilian ship. Not a liner like the Titanic, but a fully fledged cruise ship.
Okay.
For those unfamiliar with ships, cruise ships are large passenger ships used mainly for vacationing. Unlike ocean liners that are used for transport, the Gustloff was a cruise ship. It was for cruising, going on holiday.
Yeah.
The Gustloff was built in 1937 by the German government as part of their Strength Through Joy program. So you're going to ask now, what is the Strength Through Joy?
Ask. Yeah. Okay. One of Hitler's better things, maybe?
Well, I will leave you to decide. The German government set up the STJ, the Strength Through Joy program, as part of the labour force reconstruction that they were engaged in after the Nazi Party came to power. Although they had taken away the trade unions and a large number of workers' rights, they launched this programme, which provided workers with a wide range of activity at heavily discounted prices.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these ranged from concerts to theatre trips to weekend trips and holidays. Workers could enter competitions and win prizes that would send them and their family to local events or on extended trips either in Germany or abroad. A series of holiday camps were built for this purpose, along with cruise ships. Of course, not every worker under the regime was entitled to be part of the scheme, but in keeping with the party's aims, all German citizens were eligible.
Yeah.
Unless they were Jewish.
Yeah. Was it like a German Butlins?
It was a whole government-run holiday thing. So it was like a holiday firm where people would, if you worked hard, then you got points. The more points you got, the more you could go through the brochure and say, I've got this number of points. It gives me a weekend away with my family at this place. Or yeah. I could go to the theatre and watch this show. And that's it. And so it's not a bad idea.
It's a pretty good idea.
It is. I mean, restrictions aside, it was very popular with the majority of people.
Yeah, I can imagine
it was.
It was
free.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
It's an incentive to work hard.
I mean, it was very popular. In 1937 alone, 9.6 million workers were eligible and took part in the programme.
Wow.
I mean, the German population was around 67 million at the time, but 19 million, that's nearly a third.
Yeah, and when you think that's a third, I mean, the population being 67 million... Normally half of that's children, so won't be eligible anyway.
Correct.
And in that time, I would say half of the adults would have been female and probably not working.
Correct.
So you're talking 9.6 million out of probably 15 million working males.
Yeah.
It's a high population.
It's a high
percentage.
Number. So, in 1937, the Robert Lee and the Wilhelm Gustloff were specially built for the purpose, and they joined several other cruise ships who were already in the program. The Gustloff was launched as the flagship of the scheme, and she was launched in May 1937. She was a medium-sized ship weighing 25,484 tons, round about half that of the Titanic.
Okay.
When the Titanic was 25 years before. So it's about half the size of the Titanic.
How did they cram that many people in?
You can see your face now.
I'm trying to work out how they managed to cram 10,000 people into a ship that size.
Okay, it was designed with a full capacity of 1,882, comprising of 1,465 passengers and 417 crew.
Okay, that makes more sense.
That's its capacity.
Yeah.
This number will have quite a bit of significance later on.
Hmm.
1882, that's a number you don't remember. All the cabins on the ship were made the same size, and this enforced the Nazi ideal of a classless society. All the public rooms and spaces were all decorated in a similar fashion, so there was nothing different. All the cabins were the same. All the areas were decorated the same.
So, in other words, they were socialist.
Yes.
Yeah, so when everyone turns around and says Hitler was right wing, he was actually left wing.
He was actually left wing, yes.
Fascist side, the genocide is right wing, but the actual policies that he came out with were very left wing.
Which is why the Nazi Party was called the National Socialist Party.
Yeah, and it annoys me because everyone says right-wing fascist, right, well, you know, this is right-wing, that's right-wing, and you think, well, actually, Hitler was left-wing, you know, as a general rule, apart from the genocide, which can, you know, I think the Aryan race thing is a right-wing ideology, isn't it, that? But the rest of his policies were all left-wing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, all social. Yeah. So in 1937, the Robert Lee and the Gustloff were specially built. They were designed that way, the two ships. They actually joined a fleet.
Yeah.
Yeah. The ship was originally intended to be named Adolf Hitler.
Okay.
All right. But the Führer himself decided to rename it after the leader of the Swiss Nazi Party, who had actually been assassinated by a Jewish medical student the year before, 1936. So Adolf Hitler himself decided on the name change after sitting next to Gustloff's widow during the memorial service.
Okay.
So
it's actually quite a nice thought.
It is.
Like, I know it's really hard to put humanity in Hitler, but that is actually quite a nice thing to do.
Do you know another ship that was going to be named the Adolf Hitler?
Hindenburg?
The Bismarck.
The Bismarck. Was it really?
Yeah.
That was named after the Otto von Bismarck,
wasn't it? Anyway, the Wilhelm Gustloff entered service with the German Strength Through Joy program on the 24th of March 1938.
Mm-hmm.
And during her cruising career, she made over 50 voyages, giving vacations to over 65,000 holidaymakers. That's just one ship.
So it was quite successful.
It was very successful. Yeah. Mind you, the ship hit the news on only its third ever sailing. She'd left Hamburg on the 1st of April 1938 under the command of Karl Lübe, who he was the captain. They were to join up with four other ships and from the STJ program.
Mm-hmm.
Der Deutsche, Der Oceanic, and Der Sierra Cordoba. And they were all going to cruise up the North Sea as a group of four. After the four ships met up, the cruise began. But unfortunately, 2 days in, the winds sped up to 100 kilometres an hour. So the ships couldn't stay together.
Yeah.
You got to remember, this is in days before radar.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, if you couldn't see the ship, then it was it. So, but if you could see it, you were too close. So the Gustav got separated, and after the storm had passed, she found herself alone on the ocean, out of sight of the other three ships. Meanwhile, a coal freighter, the Pegaway, which had departed England on the 2nd of April, bearing in mind this is 1938,
so yes, before the war,
The Pegaway departed England on the 2nd of April, bound for Hamburg. She had also been caught up in the storm. Cargo and machinery had been washed away from the Pegaway's depth, and it come they'd been washed off the decks, and the ship had lost manoeuvrability as the storm increased. By April the 4th, it was taking on water and it was sinking slowly.
Okay.
So at 4 a.m. on the 4th of April, Captain Ward of the Pegaway issued an SOS. The closest of the ships that answered the call was the Wilhelm Gustloff, and it was 2 hours away. At 6 a.m., the Gustloff reached the Pegaway. She launched her lifeboat number one with a crew of 12 under the command of Second Officer Mayer. Lifeboat number one was an oar-powered lifeboat.
Mm-hmm.
But the seas were too rough for it to actually reach the Pegaway, and for a time it looked like they would need rescuing as well. So the captain of the Gustloff put lifeboat number six with a crew of 10 into the water under the command of Second Officer Sherman. And that was lowered. As it had a motor, it was better able to handle the waves. And after assisting lifeboat one, it then headed back towards the Gustloff.
Yep.
Dropped off the people from number one and then went out to the Pegaway.
Okay.
One by one, the 19 men on the Pegaway jumped into the sea and got hauled onto the lifeboat. Because it was too rough for the lifeboat to get to the ship. So the crew from the Pegaway jumped into the sea and were picked up.
Oh, I bet that was cold. North Sea's freezing.
Lifeboat and headed back to the Gustloff. By 7:45, everybody had been rescued and they reached safety. The Pegaway rolled over to the port, over to its port side, which is the left, and it sank. Lifeboat number one had been so badly damaged that after the crew had climbed the ladder to safety, it was actually set adrift, and it later actually washed up on the shore on the 2nd of May. But the German propaganda machine swung into action and reported this rescue in amazing detail.
Okay.
Yeah, so you...
so it's been made out like it was...
absolutely fantastic, yeah.
Which you would do, to be fair.
After this, the Gustloff went back to her normal cruising. But her life as a cruise ship was short-lived. It only lasted 17 months. And 1938 saw her take up the unusual role as a polling station.
Okay.
Okay, she anchored 3 miles off of the British port of Tilbury.
Yeah.
In international waters. The German government at the time believed that all German-speaking nations should be entitled to a vote in one united empire.
Okay.
And in April 1938, it decided that they were going to democratically ask the populace of Germany and Austria if the two countries should be joined. Germans and Austrians living in the UK were given the opportunity to vote on this, and the Wilhelm Gustloff was chosen to act as the voting point for them.
Okay.
So she became a polling station.
That actually does make sense, because they can't put a vote in Britain for it, but they're giving German people the chance to
have a say.
Put it in international waters where, it's not a bad idea. Kind of like Scotland's independent vote.
Mm. The Wilhelm Gustloff would have gone back to providing cruises for the STJ program, but the war got in the way. She became a troop transport and, as such, was used to bring home members of the German Condor League from the Spanish Civil War. And despite not being able to fulfil her original design as a cruise ship, she was still useful, and they converted her to act as a hospital ship for German forces.
Okay.
So for 14 months, she acted as a floating hospital for soldiers injured on the Eastern Front.
Yeah, that's the Russian front for those. Well, actually, yeah. No, it wasn't at that time, was it?
The year 1940s,
it's close, isn't it?
It's close.
Yeah, it would have been just as they turned to fight the Russians, wouldn't it?
Okay, in 1940, in November, her white hospital ship colours were changed to the standard military grey, and she became a floating barracks.
Okay.
So she was gone from a cruise ship to a transport ship to a hospital ship to a house.
Yeah.
A big hotel. Yeah.
Hmm.
Ironically, she became home to approximately 1,000 U-boat trainees of the 2nd Submarine Training Division and was based at a place called Gdynia in Poland. And it was there that she stayed. Now, she was there a long time. But by the end of 1944, it was clear that Germany was losing the war. The Thousand-Year Reich was falling apart, and the lands that had been colonised by Germany were slowly being overrun by the Russian army.
Yeah.
And as the Russian army advanced on East Prussia, Admiral Karl Dönitz began preparation for Operation Hannibal. Now, Operation Hannibal was the mass evacuation of German troops and civilians from the area. And it was scheduled to begin on January the 21st, 1945. An estimated 2 million Germans would eventually be brought to the west in this operation that far exceeded the British evacuation of Dunkirk.
Yeah, just a little bit. 2 million?
Yeah. You thought Britain did well getting the soldiers out of Dunkirk.
How many did we get out? 100,000, wasn't it? Something like that.
The Germans got 2 million out from the Russian advance. You don't hear much about that.
No, it's because they lost.
Operation Hannibal. As we've always said, history is written by the victors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Germans are... I was talking to a German a few months ago, and they basically said that in Germany they are taught to be embarrassed about their past. They're literally taught at school. They're barely taught about the war. And what they are taught, they're supposed to be disgusted in their own history, which I find wrong. I think that's totally wrong because...
It's history.
Yeah,
history. You can't change it. You learn from it.
Yeah. So, but I mean, something like this is good history from Germany's side. Do you know what I mean?
You got 2 million out.
Yeah, that's an impressive feat.
So. It is, you know. The Wilhelm Gustloff was going to play its part in this.
Mm.
Why are we talking about 2 million? Believe it or not, the Germans were not popular.
No shit.
And the advancing Russian army was taking out their revenge on any German that they encountered. And unfortunately, this also included the civilians. Their actions were in retaliation for all the atrocities committed by German forces in the preceding invasion of Eastern Europe. And the atrocities carried out once they were there.
Yeah, I mean, the Germans were pretty bad when they went into Russia.
By this time, the world had been made aware of the death camps, and the average Russian soldier was in no mood to be lenient with anybody associated with Germany.
Yeah.
The Russian army was advancing so quickly that many of the exit routes had already been cut off before the Gustloff was given the order to prepare to sail. She was ordered to bring the 1,000 sailors of the 2nd Submarine Training Division and 373 female naval auxiliaries back to Western Germany. There was, in reality, no room for these women, so they were placed in the bowels of the ship. They were actually placed in the drained swimming pool and the lower decks.
Yeah.
That's where they put them. 373 women. The ship, which had been static for around 4 years, needed a substantial amount of time to get ready. They didn't have that amount of time.
No.
In fact, it was totally unprepared for her to sail. 10 of her 22 lifeboats were actually missing.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, Captain Peterson, who was now in charge of the ship, sent crew members around the harbour to collect anything suitable which could be commandeered and strapped down on the sun deck and anywhere else that could be utilised. Another problem, the ship didn't actually have a full crew. I mean, for the past four years, she hadn't actually needed one.
No, she's
now she did. Yeah. So anybody who could take a place in the crew was given a place.
Yeah.
Yeah. The journey to Kiel, which is where they were going to go, was not going to be an easy one. And the Gustav was supplied with 3 anti-aircraft guns, which were mounted on her decks, along with 3 105mm and 8 20mm guns. These would be her only defence. Mm-hmm. With the Red Army so close, the tide of refugees became overwhelming. So many civilians tried to get a place on board that by the afternoon of the 29th of January, the ship had stopped taking on any more. 7,956 additional people had actually made it onto a ship built for 1,400.
Okay.
A further 2,000 managed to force their way onto the ship before it could actually leave port, taking the total on board to well over 12,000. It's not a big ship, and you've got 12,000 people on it.
Bet they regret that.
I mean, also believed to be on board was the Amber Room, which had been looted by the Nazis from Catherine's Palace in St. Petersburg. You know what the Amber Room was?
No.
The Amber Room was a chamber decorated in amber panels, backed with gold leaf and mirrors. It was had been constructed in the 18th century in Prussia, and it, at the time, was considered to be the 8th wonder of the world. Yeah.
Okay.
So it cannot be confirmed that it was on board, but it was certainly in the vicinity of the Gustloff at the time, and has since disappeared from history.
Is it that, by any chance?
It is that.
Sorry, I just...
You've just pulled it up on the internet.
I've just pulled it up. Yeah, this is the joys of modern technology, isn't it?
Yes.
Wow. How was that in a ship?
They looted it from the palace, took it apart, and it could have been on the Gustloff. Could have been.
Hmm.
Because it was in the vicinity of the port, and then it disappeared, and the only ship leaving was the Gustloff.
I just found, they reckon they actually found it. See, this is what I mean. I'm in the middle of a podcast, so I've just found something. It says Polish divers say they have found the wreck of a German Second World War ship that may help solve the decades old mystery about the whereabouts of the Amber Room, an ornate chamber that the Nazis looted from Tsarist Palace in Russia. Decorated with amber gold, the room was part of Catherine's Palace near St. Petersburg. It was last seen in Königsberg, then a Baltic port in Germany, but now is a Russian enclave. And it's saying that they reckon they found it on a ship, but it doesn't.
Name the ship.
Doesn't name the ship.
There you go. Well,
yeah, doesn't name the ship. But they have found
what they believe to be.
It says, the ship left the vessel, left Königsberg in a hurry with a large cargo and a large capacity on board. All this put together stimulates the human imagination, finding the German ship and the crates with the continent. Yet to be unknown. It says it was found at the bottom of the Baltic Sea.
There you go.
So it doesn't tell you what the ship is, but it has. They reckon they may have found it.
Right. When was that dated?
That was 2019. Yeah. So
a few years ago.
Yeah. But it does. The fact they're not naming the ship, but this one does seem.
Yeah, it's possible. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems very highly likely. That's quite impressive. Oh. Anyway, back to the story. Okay. Sorry.
So, shortly after midday on January the 30th, the heavily overloaded Gustloff pulled away from the harbour wall to actually prevent more people from attempting to get on board. Not to sail, but to pull away to get so nobody could get on it. It was very cold. The temperature was between minus 10 and minus 18 degrees. So that is 0 to minus 14 Fahrenheit for your American listeners.
That's cold.
That's FC.
Yeah.
Freezing cold.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a water temperature of 0 to minus 4 degrees.
And for those of you who haven't worked it out, sea water doesn't freeze at 0 degrees.
Like, yeah.
It wasn't ice.
The ship was vastly overloaded. And she wasn't alone. It was originally planned that the Gustloff would be one ship in a larger convoy. However, due to mechanical faults on the other two ships, she was alone. The other two ships were forced to turn back.
Yep.
Which left the Gustloff with the only torpedo boat, the Low, to accompany it. There were concerns about the journey. Remember, this ship had been stationary for 4 years. The engines were untested. The Baltic Sea was not fully under German control. It was a war zone. Parts of the Baltic Sea had been mined by the Russians in order to prevent the German Navy from supporting the defence of the area. And the Gustloff's captain, Frederick Peterson, had decided he would travel no faster than 12 knots. It's about 14 miles per hour.
Nice and slow.
This was, in his opinion, to ensure the stability of the overloaded ship and to relieve the strain on the engines. He was concerned that the engines could fail after so many years of not actually running.
Mm-hmm.
Now, remember, the naval unit he was transporting were submariners. And their commander was equal rank to Peterson. And that was Captain Wilhelm Zahn. And Wilhelm Zahn disagreed with this speed and recommended a speed of 15 knots. Now, he argued that it would reduce the chances of an attack by Russian submarines. Should they be in the area, they couldn't match the speed. The Russian submarines were known to be unable to get to 15 knots.
They were slow. They weren't very good, to be fair, the Russian submarines.
No.
Same with their planes and their weapons. And
now, you have a submarine training captain.
Yeah.
Who is advising the captain of the Gustloff that he needs to be 15 knots, not 12.
Yeah, because of attack.
Because of attack by submarines, who this particular captain was an expert in.
Yeah.
Because he trained submariners. Peterson also rejected the recommendations of the first officer, a gentleman called Lewis Rees, who advised a course that hugged the coastline.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a route that ran the risk of hitting Russian landmines, but would be too shallow for Russian submarines.
Yeah, and also closer to the coast is more likely to be rescued.
The other route was a route far away from the shore, avoiding the mines, and from shore-based observers.
Yeah.
So that's the other option. The case was given for both, but ultimately, the Gustloff left Gottenhafen and headed for deep water, the route that was known to be clear of mines. It was thought that the conditions were too bad for submarines to operate, so rather than a zigzag pattern, the ship would run a straight course towards Kiel in order to get there as quickly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But running at 12 knots.
Yeah.
The exact departure time is known, and it was 6 minutes past 3 in the afternoon. And it's known because a message was sent by the ship and was picked up by a British monitoring station, and it gave the time and direction where they were going.
Okay, so if the British picked it up, so did anyone.
The weather was awful. Ice was floating on the sea surface. Heavy snow was mixed with hail and pelting every single section of the 684-foot-long ship. The wind was near gale strength. Foam from breaking waves was blown into streaks along the wind direction, and airborne spray hit anybody standing out on the decks. Below decks, the thousands of passengers attempted to settle into their assigned areas for the journey. All are instructed over the loudspeaker to wear life jackets provided. Under no circumstances were they to remove them. Above deck, the wind, snow and hail continued to pelt the Gustloff. The seas became rougher as they left the bay behind. Seasickness begins to set in for many.
Yeah.
Unable to relieve themselves overboard, the onboard toilets quickly became blocked and the smell below decks was awful.
Yeah, I can imagine.
People throwing up, people being ill, people unable to go to the toilet. You've got 12,000 people and they can't go out on deck.
Yeah. And when someone throws up, the smell makes you want to throw up. It does me.
Around 6 o'clock in the evening, the Gustloff's radio technician, a gentleman called Rudy Lange, received word that a convoy of minesweepers was also sailing in the same channel, but coming from the opposite direction. Continuing on this path risked one of the passenger liners in the German fleet having a head-on collision with a minesweeper because they wouldn't be able to see it. So they could turn the ship's navigation lights on to alert the convoy to their presence. Who else might be they give their location away to?
Well, anyone who's against them. And you got to remember, this ship's painted in battleship grey.
Mm. Okay. Rudy Lange hadn't received any messages reporting enemy ships, planes, or submarines. To be honest, you ain't going to get any planes in that weather. So, yeah. But they hadn't received any. Unfortunately for the Gustloff, the fact is enemy submarines had been spotted in the area. But the bad weather had caused these reports not to get through. If the Gustloff was spotted by planes, the anti-aircraft guns on board were available for defence.
Yeah.
In reality, they were useless. They had already frozen solid on the upper decks. Now, Commander Zahn wanted the navigation lights turned off, or left off, to follow war protocol. Now, he is the submarine commander.
Yeah.
Peterson, the captain of the Gustloff, wants them on. There had to be a reason why the convoy was travelling in darkness. The minesweepers.
Yeah.
After continually arguing, Captain Peterson himself flips the switch up and the red and green navigation lights shone out over the sea, cutting through the darkness.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Origin of the message about the minesweepers was never actually discovered, and none of the radio operators on the Gustloff or the Lau, which was the
other ship,
ever claimed to have received it. So it's unclear whether this was a misunderstanding or sabotage. No record of any message relating to the presence of minesweepers has ever been discovered or and known to be transmitted.
Okay.
Still, the worst part of the voyage was now behind them, and the Gustloff had reached a place called the Stolp Bank. The bridge crew shared the sentiment that the most dangerous waters were now behind them. Around 9:15, 21:16 hours, the Gustloff was rocked by three explosions. It took her less than an hour to sink.
No, they weren't out of safe waters then.
Several days before the Guslav left, the Russian submarine, the S-13, under the command of Captain Alexander Marinesko, had entered the Gulf of Danzig without informing his central command. He'd been patrolling with other submarines off the coast near Memel without encountering any ships. Being aware of enemy activity around the ports in the Danzig area, he went there in hope of finding some targets. Now, Marinesko was not considered a good captain by the Soviet Navy. He had a major alcohol problem and was due to face court-martial upon his return from this particular mission after being caught drunk in a brothel off duty. He was in desperate need of a positive result for him and his 47 crew, and this would have offset the upcoming case. Around 8 o'clock in the afternoon, his submarine was on the surface charging its batteries when he noticed lights in the distance. At first, he mistook them for the Hell Lighthouse on the coast, but a brief break in the weather revealed it to be a ship. He identified it as an enormous ocean liner, over 20,000 tons, and he was certain it was packed with men who had trampled on Mother Russia and were now fleeing for their lives. This made it a military target, so he decided that the S-13 was the one to do it. He decided to place his submarine between the ship and the coast, as an attack from that direction would be least expected. He also knew that the weather would prevent any use of the guns mounted on the ship, as they would be frozen solid. The same would go for the submarine detection equipment on the ship alongside it, the Low.
Yeah.
Having manoeuvred into position, Marinesko loaded his four torpedo tubes. Each one bore a special message written on it to the Germans. Torpedo 1 had "For the Motherland." Torpedo 2, "For Stalin." Torpedo 3, "For the Soviet People." And Torpedo 4, "For Leningrad."
I wonder if that's where it started, writing on the bombs.
Maybe. It was written in Russian. Ridiculous, really, when you think about it, isn't it? Because the only way they're going to read it is if it doesn't go off.
Yeah. And they probably wouldn't read it anyway, because the Russian writing looks like a cat's run across the page.
Alexander Marinesko orders all four torpedoes to be fired. Three sped towards their target, which still actually had not been identified. One torpedo, number two, the one that was for Stalin, remained behind, stuck in a torpedo tube.
Okay.
The first torpedo hit the Wilhelm Gustloff's port side and shook the entire ship. It struck the forward crew cabins and cargo areas in the bow, blasting a hole in the side of the ship, with a huge water plume shooting up into the air. Unfortunately, this was the area where the crew members had been housed, and most were killed instantly. Up on the bridge, the first thought was the ship had hit a mine, and immediately Captain Peterson ordered the watertight doors closed to prevent flooding. This had the added effect of sealing off those crew still alive in the bow.
Yeah, I think that's brutal, that, isn't it? You got to kill people just to save the rest.
This decision, that was to have major consequences in the next hour, it was going to have major consequences, because those now sealed in the bow section were the only crew on board who knew how to operate the lifeboats.
But then, if they had a hit, if it was a mine, it would have kept the ship afloat. The ship can... So it's a catch-22, isn't it?
A few seconds later, the second torpedo strikes further aft, which is a naval term for further back, and it strikes the area which held the Gustloff's swimming pool and the 373 of the women's naval auxiliary. Torpedo first blew through the locker rooms on the port side, shattering the beautiful tile mosaics and turning them into lethal pieces of flying shrapnel, killing many of the women where they slept. The large glass ceiling over the pool shattered and came down, basically shards of glass pouring down and stabbing the women who were crammed into the swimming pool. The empty swimming pool now turned red with the blood of those injured in the blast. Then came the ice-cold sea to fill the pool for the first time in years. Of the 373 marine helfern, female auxiliaries, who had been placed there, only three got out alive.
Wow.
The third torpedo was next. It hit the Wilhelm Gustloff in the engine room amidships and knocked out the power supply. Aside from the sound of incoming rush of cold seawater, smoke and fire, the air was filled with the mayhem of stampeding and screaming and shouting people. Immediately the ship lists to port, so it starts to go over to the left-hand side. The bridge tried to call the engine room for a status update, but there was no reply. Rudy Lange tried to send an SOS signal, he was the radio operator, but he was forced to use a small emergency radio transmitter that, because there was no power to run the main one. With the transmission range of only 2,000 metres, only the low was able to receive the distress call. But the low picked up the SOS and began transmitting it further with their powerful radio. Wilhelm Gustloff's emergency lights flickered on, illuminating the chaos in a dull light that made desperate boarding in Guttenhaven a few hours before look like a relaxed party. Below decks, the frantic rush to get topside began. Refugees trampled over one another, kicking and screaming as water began flooding the cabins and corridors. Many did not survive the frenzied charge to the decks. Those that could tried to make their way out onto the upper decks, filling the stairwells and companionways. Anyone who tripped was trampled underfoot, and this included many of the children. Some just couldn't get out and were seen trying to break the reinforced glass windows. Women and children's first rule just didn't happen. Those injured, the bedridden servicemen, were just left where they were. They were unable to move, and there were a lot of them. Remember, until a couple of days before the Gustloff sailed, she'd been a barracks, and before then a hospital ship. The refugees' problem didn't stop when those that could reached the open decks. With the ship listing to port, only half the lifeboats could be launched. The weather had not abated, the boats, the ropes, the davits, and all available equipment had frozen solid, much of it to the decks.
And the people who could control the lifeboats weren't even there.
Many people slipped on the ice-covered decks and fell into the frozen sea. Ice-covered ropes just snapped when they were lowering the boats. The defensive guns attached to the Gustloff's decks broke free and crashed into the sea, taking at least one full lifeboat with them.
Wow.
Add all this to the fact that in reality no one knew how to use the escape equipment, as those had been killed by the first torpedo or sealed in the decks below, like you just said. There were reports of gunshots ringing out as officers took their families into their cabins to kill everybody and then themselves in order to avoid the death of drowning or freezing. Hundreds of people slipped, fell or jumped into the freezing water only to die of exposure. Thousands of screams filled the black night air as sounds of splashing was everywhere. And it was on all sides. Just before the Gustloff sank, her stern began to rise out of the air. Eerily, to say goodbye. The entire ship regained power and every light on board illuminated the night sky. With her final blaze of farewell and all the alarms sounding, she sank. The Wilhelm Gustloff sank, taking 9,343 people with her in less than 70 minutes. There were 1,252 survivors. By 10:30 in the evening, the flagship of the German cruise line industry had slipped beneath the waves. Both Captain Peterson and Captain Zahn made it off the ships.
Ooh, that shouldn't happen.
That is the story of the world's deadliest single ship disaster. Initially, the Russians stated that the ship was a legitimate military target and that the women on board at the time of the sinking were described as SS personnel from the concentration camps. It was later proved that they were just naval auxiliaries. So why isn't this shipwreck and sinking known as it should be? Neither of the two sides in this incident wanted it to be publicised. The Germans didn't want to admit they were losing the war and evacuating civilians. They didn't want to be seen to be allowing a vastly overloaded ship on a voyage without protection, nor did they want it made public that they allowed civilians onto an obviously military ship. It had guns.
Yeah, and it was painted...
grey.
Yeah, if it was white, it probably wasn't... You know, the hospital ship, if they'd left it white, they probably wouldn't have attacked it, because it's not a legitimate military target.
No. The Russians didn't want to admit that a rogue submarine commander had sunk a ship full of women and children.
Even though it was technically a legitimate target. He didn't actually do anything wrong. In the middle of... I know when you look at it, it does, but... in the grand scheme of things, as a submariner, he's come up, he's seen lights on a ship, he's looked at the ship, the ship's battleship grey, it's got guns on board, it's a legitimate target.
Mm.
He's not done anything wrong. He doesn't know that there's women and children on that, he just sees a ship.
No, but the end result was there were women and children on board, so the Russians didn't want seen to publicise it.
Yeah.
So, with everything that's going on, the story was buried by both sides. That is why very few people know much about it.
Mm.
They might know that the Gustloff existed. They might know that the Gustloff holds the record for the most number of lives lost in a single incident. But that's it. They don't know the story.
No. No, I didn't. I mean, I'd heard the name, and I remember you saying it was a shipwreck and it was a cover up, and that was pretty much all the information you gave me. Mm. It was a cruise liner ship, and it was a cover up, but I didn't really know much more about it.
Mm. I mean, the Gustloff is laying in 47 meters of water. It is not deep.
No,
but it is a designated war grave. So you can't dive on it.
Can you not?
No, you have to have special permission to dive on a war grave.
Ah, why is that?
Because it's a war grave, I presume. 11 days after the sinking of the Gustloff, the S-13, still under command of Captain Marinesco, attacked and sank another German ship, the General von Steuben. This killed another 4,500 people. This ship was again trying to evacuate civilians and wounded from the advancing Russian army.
Bloody hell.
Captain Marinesco was court-martialed upon his return and thus deemed not suitable to be a hero.
Oh, shit.
For the sinking. And instead of gaining the title Hero of the Soviet Union... he was awarded the Lesser Order of the Red Banner. He was downgraded in rank to lieutenant.
Oh, don't say it that way.
Lieutenant.
You're not, lieutenant. You're British. It's lieutenant.
Lieutenant?
Yeah, German.
Yeah, no. He was downgraded to lieutenant.
Why do we pronounce it like that when it is actually lieutenant?
It's because it's French.
Yeah. I thought so.
And he was dishonorably discharged from the Soviet Navy in October 1945. In 1960, Marinesco was reinstated as Captain Third Class and granted a full pension. And in 1963, he was given the traditional ceremony due a captain upon the successful return from a mission. He died 3 weeks later of cancer at the age of 50. And he was posthumously named Hero of the Soviet Union by General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev in 1990.
Is he the one with a birthmark?
Yes.
Yeah.
So
I don't agree with that. Like, I understand he, the first one, I don't know, I mean, that von Struboen, I don't know if that was, again, another legitimate target. But realistically, that man's just killed nearly 1,500 people.
15,000.
15,000 people, mainly civilians. He deserves stringing up. not given a reward.
Well, he was demoted. He was just...
Demoted?
Yeah.
I mean... there's mistakes, and then there's mistakes, isn't there?
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, I remember, and it, not something to laugh about, but I remember the Gulf War, and you would hear every night the our British news would read out X amount of British servicemen killed in Afghanistan or whatever. And
it would be Iraq.
Iraq. But the amount of times that you would hear British servicemen killed by friendly fire, British servicemen killed by friendly fire, servicewoman friendly fire, and it was always the Americans. Like, the for a country that owns guns, they couldn't shoot their enemy, they could only shoot the British targets. And that is a mistake. I mean, I actually think an American shot down a British helicopter as well in Iraq. And the fact that Iraqis didn't have helicopters makes it even more stupid. But that is a mistake. It's the loss of a handful of people. It's a mistake. It's a bad thing to happen. This guy's killed 15,000 people by mistake.
Hmm.
That's not...
I mean, you're going
that's
on
not an
that.
Error. That's not demotion. That's you should be arrested. It just doesn't make sense. But
yeah, I mean, yeah, I'd say you're going on the Iraq war. They don't... Yes, it's called blue on blue, isn't it? It's friendly fire. It's a very difficult one because
a lot of the times
shoot first and ask questions later, because if you don't shoot first, they're going to shoot you.
Yeah.
But like you said, if they don't have helicopters and you shoot a helicopter down, you kind of think, yeah. I mean, there was an incident where a group of British Centurion tanks were attacked, and obviously they are British tanks. They're not Russian made. They're fairly obvious that they were British tanks. But again, it's got to work both ways. There will be incidents where
British
have attacked.
But again, we're not going to say that, are we? We're hardly going to come out with our four servicemen died today, killed by American friendly fire. But we got 10 of theirs. You know what I mean? It's not going to...
It's not good. It's one of those things that happens. And
it's an unfortunate consequence.
It is. But like you said, it did happen more than it should have done.
Yeah, it does. And modern day, it shouldn't be happening at all, really. I mean...
You look at the current thing, you know, it seems to be that in order to get one person, it doesn't matter how many you get... That's it. You know, the current situation in the Middle East, there one side is obviously trying its best to take out the nasties,
mm-hmm.
and unfortunately some of the good people, I don't know whether they're good, but
civilians,
some non-combatants
people. Yeah, innocent people
are in the way. What do you do? Well, you know, you don't aim for the non-combatants. You try and hit the target that you're hitting. Yeah. But the issue there is you have the problem is the people you are trying to hit know this.
Yeah, and they, I mean,
so they stand behind them. Yeah. And you, if you're going to take out the nasty people, you are going to end up taking out some of the, what you just referred to as innocents, but I would refer to as non-fighters and non-combatants. So you can't win.
No. But, I mean, the thing in the Israel-Palestine thing is, I mean, I've got my own opinion on it, and there's way too... We ain't got enough time to go into my opinions on it. Growing up, my best friends were Jewish. So I have probably a slightly biased opinion on this compared to most people, but please don't hate me for that. That's just how I was brought up. But what I do say with this is at least Israel are going for the Hamas fighters. They might, people are getting in the way, and the way they're doing it might be wrong, but they are aiming for them. Whereas when the British did it in the Second World War and we went for Dresden, we didn't really care and we flattened Dresden. And there was no thought about, well, there might be some German soldiers there. We knew it was a city. We didn't care. The Americans, exactly the same at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There was no thought process to...
Well, it weren't military targets as such. There may have been military personnel there, but the end result was...
We flattened
Dresden.
Yeah,
you know that.
I
mean,
I'd love to do a story on that because it's not a part of the Second World War. For British, I mean, we're obviously taught about the Second World War from a young age, but we don't talk about Dresden. Like, it's never mentioned in any of our historical books. And if you watch history documentaries on it, a lot of it is Germans talking about Dresden. It's German authors, German people talking about... It's like we talk about the Blitz, and the Blitz was horrific for London, but London wasn't a strategic military target. There was very few military in London. They were all... They were going for the political...
It was designed... The Germans, or the German High Command, decided that they would demoralise the British public in the hope that... they would force the British government to surrender.
Yeah,
you know, we're taking all this flak and all this thing every single night. Do something about it. If it would all stop if you surrendered.
Yeah,
the British don't do that.
No,
you know. No, whereas the Japanese, they wiped out.
Yeah,
Hiroshima and
even
Nagasaki.
Then, the Japanese didn't want to surrender.
No, but their leaders overruled them.
Yeah. I mean, the emperor said, under no circumstances are we going to surrender. And then the first bomb was dropped, and he still said, yeah, it was bad, but no, we're still not surrendering. And the second one was dropped, and they went, yeah, okay.
How
many more have they got? How long can this go on? Okay, maybe it's time to talk. But I would say the Japanese and the British have a very similar mentality in that. It's, we don't care... we will fight to the end. And the difference is with us is if we lose, we'll hold our hands up and go, yeah, okay, we lost. Whereas the Japanese will fall on their sword, and we don't do that.
Because you're no good to ever go back.
I never understand that. But
it's an honour thing, isn't
it?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, but honour is... but then again, that's a Christian thing, isn't it? I mean, like, I know we're not religious. Well, I'm not religious. I know you are a little bit. But, I mean, the Bible is very... very, very strict on suicide. You don't do it.
Mm.
So the Japanese not being Christian and not coming from that mentality, their honour is that. So do you know what I mean? There's a little bit of change in the way things work in different countries. But I do think the British mentality of keep calm and carry on and just don't let it bother you.
Yeah.
I mean, you were police officer 7/7, weren't you, in June?
I was, yeah.
Yeah. So, for those of you who don't know, that was the terrorist attack in London where they attacked the London Tube and the buses in London and killed a fair few people. I don't know the exact number, but there was quite a few, and it was a couple of years after 9/11. And literally, the British, This was King's Cross, wasn't it? King's Cross Station.
Edgware Road was one of them, and I ended up on the scene of the bus in Russell Square.
Yeah. But the next day, those buses were running and those tubes were running. I mean, obviously the line where it had been blown up, that wasn't running, but the rest of the tube was back at work.
We just put tape around the road.
Just put tape around it and carried
around,
on.
We just sealed off that particular road and the buses took a detour. Yeah.
And that was it. And that is...
We were still pulling bits of bodies out the out the bus. I mean, Liz, my other half, she was working at the mortuary. She was seconded to the mortuary for a week.
Yeah.
You know, just receiving bits of bodies.
Yeah, people forget that. I mean, just to put you in, obviously people, if you listen to this show regularly, you know my dad was a police officer for 22 years. What you don't know is my stepmom was a police officer for 14 years, and my brother has been in the police for how long?
I think Ashley's been in just about 14, 15 years now. Yeah.
So I come from a family of police officers, and growing up, there was no way you were being a naughty child or committing a crime. It was... Yeah, I don't think people know that. I mean, we don't really talk about anyone else on the show, but yeah, it's quite crazy to think, actually. I didn't realise Ashley had been in the police that long. Wow.
Yeah, he has.
So, yeah, so there you go. That just gives you a background of my childhood there, of not being able to...
not being able to get into trouble.
No, not being... Although I do remember once, I know this is completely off topic now, but I do remember once I used to have a moped. For those of you who don't know, it's a little 50cc motorbike. And I was riding through Harrow, and I saw behind me a blue flashing light. And this was probably a week after Dad's dad, had de-restricted my moped. So mopeds in England have a little washer on the running belt, which restricts them to 30 miles an hour. If you take this washer out, the motorbikes will go about 60, 70 miles an hour. You're not allowed to do that, so... My dad wouldn't do it, by the way, because it's against the law and he's a police officer. So I took it to Grandad, and Grandad took it off. Brilliant. Well, happy. So I'm going through Harrow, which is where my dad was working, and all of a sudden I see blue lights behind me, thinking, oh no, they've obviously clocked me doing over 70. This police officer must have been about, I don't know, 6 foot, massive black gentleman. Do you know what you were doing, sir? No. I've got you on the ANPR camera, which at the time I didn't know what that was. It's a number plate reader. Yeah. Are you Dave Gamblin, son? Yes. Oh, say hi to your dad for me. And he got back in the car and walked out. I have never been so scared in my life. And I thought I was going to get arrested for doing 35 in a 30. And this guy thought it was a joke.
Yeah.
Do you remember?
I do.
Yeah.
Get to hear about that.
Yeah, completely off topic, but
anyway, going back, that was the story of the Guslov.
I think it's a great story. I think it's a horrific story, isn't it? I mean, you're talking about the loss of innocence, you know. And if you're fleeing a country, this is what proper refugees do. Proper refugees, they get on a boat with their women and children. So if you're British, you know what I'm getting at. But they get on a boat, men, women, children, they all get on the boat at the same time, proper refugees, and they're fleeing the country. And for something like that to happen is horrific.
You've got to think, you know, three people out of 373 women all crammed into a swimming pool.
Dead.
Gone.
I might want to know how the three of them got out.
I have no idea.
You know what I mean? It's not...
Perhaps they weren't in the actual room at the time. Yeah, perhaps they were somewhere else. Perhaps, you know, perhaps they just happened to be on the outskirts of it. And you've got to remember, I mean, if you're an injured soldier,
you're
in a bed, and the ship that you're sailing in gets hit, you're going nowhere.
You've just got
to lay there and wait for the water to come in.
Yeah. I'm not sure I'm a fan of the captains getting off the ship, though. Like, I know that sounds really stupid, but it is, it's almost maritime law. Is it maritime law, or is it just how's it supposed to be done? You're supposed to be the last off the ship. But, I mean...
The captain is responsible for the ship and the people under his command. And in years gone by, if the captain stayed on the ship, then the ship was still owned by the company. So, therefore, it couldn't be salvaged. Whereas if the captain left the ship is abandoned, and if somebody comes along and the ship doesn't sink, they can claim the ship as their own and take it away. So the captain is associated with the ship. So if he stays on board, the ship remains that what it is.
Yeah.
And the captain should realistically ensure that every person under his command has left before he leaves.
So it's just for insurance purposes. It's not like a, it's not actually law.
It's not a law, but it's an unwritten one. Mm. If you get what I mean.
Yeah. Unless you're captain of the Concordia.
Oh. When he, I tell you what, that amazes me. If have you, this is going off topic again, isn't it?
Yeah. Well,
the Concordia. For those American listeners that are listening, the Concordia was a cruise ship. A couple of years ago, and it was a very big one.
It was massive, wasn't it?
And the captain tried to impress a couple of people in a village as it was sailing down a strait between a couple of islands. And it got too close to the island and did a Titanic, basically. It hit a rock and cut a hole in the side of the ship. And the ship went down.
Well, it listed, did it? It wasn't deep enough to sink, was it?
No, it tipped over onto its side and stayed there a couple of hundred yards from shore. And I would say the vast majority of people got off.
Yeah,
I think it was only, sort of, off the top of my head, 20 people died on it, or somewhere around that figure.
I don't think it was very many.
But if you actually go onto YouTube and type in conversation between the Italian Coast Guard and the captain of the Concordia. The captain of the Concordia left the ship.
Straight away.
And claimed that he had fallen into a lifeboat and was directing the evacuation from said lifeboat. And the Italian Coast Guard basically swore at him and ordered him to get back on the ship and do it from there, because that's what captains do. And I believe that the captain has actually been imprisoned.
Yeah, he is. He was sent to jail.
He was sent to jail. So, for not doing, because he refused to get back on the ship. So, yeah, that's one to look at.
Yeah,
that might be an interesting one for one of my...
I think just the story of the captain.
The captain.
Brilliant. I'm
not going to turn around and think I know his name begins with an S, but I'm not going to try.
No, I don't know.
But there we are.
I remember watching a Netflix.
It's quite a good thing. I've actually seen the Concordia.
What, on its side?
No. We saw it. We were on a cruise about a year beforehand.
You did? Yeah, I remember.
We got a photograph of the Concordia. It was huge, because our little tiny ship only had 3,000 people on it.
Yeah, and your little tiny ship was huge.
And our ship was huge.
And then you could see in the background this, like...
big thing. And that was the Concordia, yeah. But there we are.
I do remember seeing that.
Yeah. Right. Well, anyway.
A little bit of off-topic at the end. But
I think the off-topic bit was almost as long as the story.
Yeah, probably. Well, I hope you enjoyed it. It was... Again, a good one. So we've now got a list of new things, new topics.
I've got to do some new ones, haven't I?
Yeah. There's a good one that I like, which is an American Civil War one.
That's the one I'm doing at the moment, isn't
it? Yes, I'm looking forward to that, because I'm not going to give too much away. It is one that I have covered an overview of, and you are taking a 1 hour section and turning it into a 1 hour show. And that's a 1 hour section of the entire battle, not just an hour. Like, literally,
I'm taking 60 minutes out of the American Civil War and making it last 60 minutes.
Yeah. So, extreme detail, but very, very interesting. That one looks pretty cool. We're looking forward to that one. I think that's probably one of your next ones, isn't it?
Quite possibly. And if anybody's got any suggestions, I am quite willing to do my research and do my bits.
Yeah.
So,
no, there you go. There we go. Liz has just come in. She's, yeah, the picture of the Concordia. I mean, that's the Concordia. And it's almost twice the size of the ship you were on. And your ship was pretty big as well, wasn't it?
So you can say, you can speak, you know, if you want to.
I'm listening.
You're listening.
Yeah.
Oh, she's got TV
she's
on.
Got her in here and she's got the TV on. She's in the other room.
You've probably heard a few coughs in the background.
she is in the other room, but she's listening to the television through her headphones because she didn't want the television to interfere with our recording. But so, yeah.
No, fantastic. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I am hopefully going to get back to recording some myself next week.
Well, that's good, because we are into July, and you've done three this year.
Yeah. They have been three really good ones, though, in fairness.
Yeah. I think I started with Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah. The Lady Jane Grey, that was a good one.
I did like that, yeah. Lady Jane Grey was good.
Yeah. So I do need to do a bit more, really.
You do, but they're fun.
Yeah, I quite enjoy it. I'm not going to bang on about how to support the show. To me, the best thing now, guys, if you want to support the show, like and follow us. That's the first thing. So whatever you're listening to, just hit subscribe. You'll get updates for everything. That's the best way to do it, because it guarantees the download for our system. And share the show. You know, Patreon's taken a bit of a hit, which I don't begrudge anybody leaving Patreon. Like I said, there has been a bit of a lull, so we are getting back onto that. So if you do want to rejoin Patreon, there will be more going forward. But if you don't want to, totally understand. But if you can, hit that subscribe button, like the show, share the show with people, and join us on Facebook.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's it. Thanks for listening, guys.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.